The following program is brought to you by We Are Many. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out wearemany.org.
This is surreal. Okay, again, I just want to give a little heads up that the talk is more depressing than what everything has been, you know. Like, there's been roses coming to me, all of these things. I appreciate all of it. But anyway, I hope you're in for this ride. I don't think the microphone works. Yeah, doesn't seem like it. So I don't know if anyone is like savvy about this stuff. But I'll try to yell as much as possible. Is this, what?
I'm happy to try to fix it. I do that for a living, so I'm happy to try to fix it.
Please. Socialism.
I haven't fixed it yet. Just trying.
We're behind you.
Sorry, I'll get out of your way. I think this, okay. This perhaps
we usually
fix
that. You keep talking, I'll try to.
Should I start?
Yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
Okay. All right. It is no secret that Venezuela is going through the deepest political, social, and economic crisis in its modern history. What we can observe now of the everyday experience of Venezuelans borders a catastrophe, a failure of meeting the emancipatory and progressive promises that socialism of the 21st century made to a new generation of Venezuelan and world dreamers. Raised in a context of hope for an unclear version of what a socialist society of a socialist society that turned into the nightmare that it is today. Venezuela is in its fourth consecutive year with the highest inflation rate in the world. The fiscal deficit is estimated at 20% to 25% this year, and the real income of the average Venezuelan has dropped dramatically. Even if salaries match inflation, the rampant scarcity of essential goods such as food, medicines, and necessary equipment to run hospitals completes what has been labeled as a humanitarian crisis. As to be expected, these alarming conditions affect the majority poor the most, despite the overrepresentation of the middle class, youth as the main victims we see in the international media and in the social media. Not too long ago, this massive layer of the population, the poor, was seen as a new agent of change who, in coordination with the president, at the time, Hugo Chavez, were building the basis for a new type of socialism. This image contrasts the reality most locals live in today. Can people hear me fine? Okay. Well, there was a no over there. Okay, well, we're trying. Over 8 million Venezuelans reported last year having eaten two or fewer meals a day due to the lack of money and food.
There are two wires that are missing, so unfortunately.
Okay.
Sorry. Missing wires.
Okay. Thank you for trying. As recorded by Venezuelan socialist feminist Anaís López Caldera, previously an active Chavista activist, now still an activist but outside of Chavismo, maternal mortality, although always very high, has experienced an increase of 90% since 1990 as a direct result of the absence of basic nutrition and access to health services for poor mothers. There has been a considerable drop in school attendance by children of poor and working class families due to a variety of factors linked to the economic crisis. The homicide rate has reached 86 people out of 100,000 inhabitants as of 2017, with the youth in the barrios and protesters in the streets being the two groups most impacted. In addition, for the first time in the country's history, Venezuelans are leaving en masse. An estimated 250,000 have crossed Colombia in the last year, leading the former Colombian president Juan Manuel Santos to close and further militarize the border to discipline migrants. What many have now called the migratory crisis doesn't have an end in sight, making the Venezuelan diaspora an unprecedented reality. This is the same country that millions of people worldwide were once deeply inspired by as a model to what a new winning left could look like. One that takes governing seriously, as Chavismo clearly did, and at the same time strongly encourage the development of grassroots organizing through the model of community councils and communes and other Bolivarian circles, etc. For close to a decade, the Bolivarian Revolution, as the project of implementing socialism of the 21st century was known, became a major source of hope for millions of progressives of all stripes in Latin America and thousands of socialists around the world. But now this revolution needs to be reassessed honestly. Understanding how we went from such high hopes as socialists to such drastic disappointment and a generalized confusion internationally on how to approach this multi-layer crisis is the first step we need to take to better relate to the working and popular classes in Venezuela. It's an extremely painful and difficult step to take, but as revolutionary socialists, I argue that we have the tools and the obligation to do so. Predictably, the right-wing nationally and mainstream politics abroad are capitalizing in this crisis and using it once again to discredit socialism as a viable option for a more just world. Everything we read and hear about Venezuela is mischaracterized to prove that every time people decide to change route to the destiny of misery and powerlessness that has been imposed upon them, it ends up in disaster. Colombia's election is a prime example of this. Right-wing Colombian president, known as El Duque, yeah, that, in the lead-up to his election in May of this year, ran a campaign that was almost exclusively focused on the horrors of Venezuela's socialism. Ads with poor, starving Venezuelans crossing the Colombian border appeared all over the country in an attempt to equate the catastrophe facing their neighboring territory with the socialist system established by the Maduro government. The message was, of course, that if Colombians failed to vote for the Uribista candidate, Colombia was to turn into a narco-communist country run by guerrilla terrorists along with Venezuela. This is a common, yeah, anyway. Similarly, the campaign in opposition to the new Mexican president, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, also spent considerable time demonizing Venezuela as the future of Mexico if the left of center candidate was elected. Luckily, as we can learn in the talk by Mexican comrades later today, this fear-mongering campaign did not work for the vast majority of Mexican voters. But what has been painfully absent is a critically important assessment of the Bolivarian Revolution from a left-wing perspective internationally. Many socialists and progressives shy away from looking too deep into the dynamics developed in the country since the birth of socialism of the 21st century to focus solely on the uncritical support for a seemingly favorable government. VenezuelanAnalysis.org, for example, a website dedicated to countering the right-wing portrayal of Venezuela in the English-speaking media, maintains a hard line of blaming everything wrong that goes on in the country on an economic war imposed by Washington and their allies. Similarly, on a panel I was a part of this past May at Historical Materialism, Toronto-based academic Jeremiah Gaster argued strongly that the left needs to back Chavismo and the Maduro government unconditionally, and that openly critiquing the Bolivarian process as counter-revolutionary benefits the narrative of imperialism and the right. Well, me and many Venezuelan comrades organizing inside and outside the country disagree. In this talk, I set to explore urgently and honestly the question of what led Venezuela to facing the most severe crisis of its existence using our Marxist framework of emancipation and liberation. Using the extensive and difficult work done by many Venezuelan socialists in the last 18 years, I will argue what I think gives us the tools to understand this crisis best, that the cause of Venezuela's dire situation is not socialism failing, but the fact that it was never implemented. Socialism of the 21st century, far from being an innovative way to understand revolution and socialism, has become a catchword for state-led social practices aimed at subsidizing, ineffectively, its way out of poverty. Consequently, what we see in Venezuela is not the crisis of a socialist society, but rather an acute crisis of capitalism led by a military, national populist government who, despite its socialist rhetoric, has actively contributed, intentionally and otherwise, to the systematic worsening of the living conditions of Venezuelans. The very same government that is supposed to lead the country to a socialism propelled by popular power, although verbally committed to a vision of radical democracy from below, is in fact authoritarian, hyper-corrupt, and not worthy of the support of genuine socialists determined to build a left that can finally win. I'd like to divide this argument in three sections. One, I want to briefly explain the economic crisis and its social consequences. In this section, I will draw heavily in the analysis of Venezuelan Marxist economist Manuel Suderland and Marxist sociologist Edgar Lander. Two, briefly describe the current political crisis and its origins. Here I rely mostly in the work of several Venezuelan comrades featured in the journal Centro de Estudios de la Realidad Latinoamericana, and if you're interested in these sources, I can give them to you after the talk. Such as Andrea Pacheco and Cesar Romero, as well as political scientist Fabrice Andreani. And three, I will try to draw the main conclusions for us socialists outside of Venezuela around this very important and controversial topic we're discussing today, so that we can focus on the very needed next steps of solidarity with the Venezuelan people. So now I'll start with the economic crisis. Today, Venezuela is living the worst economic crisis of its history. It's a giant thing to say, but bear with me. The government blames the failure of implementing Chavez's socialist ideal to an economic war waged by the local capitalists in the United States. Comparing their government to Salvador Allende's 1972 Chile, they argue that they are doing the best they can against such powerful enemies. And sure enough, the pressures against the Venezuelan government since the year 2000 have been the focus of this talk in previous years. Everywhere from the well-documented support of the US to the opposition-led 2002 coup against Chavez, to the latest round of sanctions against Venezuelan politicians, as well as Trump's recent threat of military intervention, are all obviously worth opposing and condemning from our side, and we have to do that. But the reality is that the economic catastrophe is only partially due to these external pressures. And it has a lot to do with a set of economic policies that have decreased national sovereignty over production, augmented the levels of state and businesses' corruption, and taken the country to a breaking point of unprecedented characteristics. Two essential policies that prove this point are A, the further integration between the state and oil production, and B, the implementation of the dual exchange rate. And this is gonna be a little difficult to understand if you've never been following this, but then the conclusion hopefully will draw it. So A, the further integration between the state and national oil production started in 2003, when a commodity boom driven by high demand from emerging markets like India and China opened up new economic possibilities in Latin America. Copper, soy, iron ore, and most importantly, oil prices rose, and all the countries able to take advantage of this opportunity for unprecedented economic growth did so. The governments of the Bolivarian Revolution capitalized in this period by using the highly profitable oil resources to create a distributionist model where direct assistance was provided to the population. All the social programs known as the missions directed to elevate the living conditions of the majority of Venezuelans by creating access to healthcare, improving education in the barrios, and expanding low-income housing emerged at this time, and they reached their peak in Chavez's second term. Furthermore, community councils were formed. Some unproductive companies were nationalized and made into cooperatives. And the National Union of Workers replaced the right-wing controlled labor union that had participated in the failed coup of 2002. This process greatly elevated the popular class's quality of life, arguably above most of Chavez's allies like Brazil or Argentina. As Lee Susser writes in 2007, which by the way, Lee Susser was trying to enter the room, but he was told to go because it's packed, so that's kind of funny. But writes in 2007, International Socialist Review, and I quote, "These gains include a reduction of poverty from 55% of the population to 34%, the achievement of literacy for 1.5 million adults, the virtual elimination of hunger through subsidized grocery stores that service 13 million people, medical care provided by Cuban doctors via free clinics in slums, reaching 18 million people, nearly 70% of the population, access to higher education for the poor and working class, and special affirmative action programs for indigenous people," end quote. The gains were undeniable, but these were largely possible due to the populist-style management of the oil boom and not to a socialist transformation of society. since it was cheaper to import all essential goods than to invest in local production, the government deprioritized all other areas of production it had nationalized and instead relied in the profits made by the state-owned oil company to import all necessary goods. This put Venezuela in a very precarious position economically, but the levels of social spending needed to keep the government relevant remained equally ambitious. When the state saw the price of oil per barrel drop from an outstanding from $120 to $9 to only rise partially and nowhere near its peak in the following years, it put the entire distributionist model to bring about socialism into question. This over-reliance in oil is nothing new in Venezuela. Venezuela first became dependent on oil in the 30s with the dictatorship of Juan Vicente Gómez, and it reached its peak in the last century during the first government of Carlos Andrés Pérez from 1974 to 1979. It was at this time that Venezuela's state nationalized the oil industry, making the state the main recipient of wealth in the country and the main decider on how this wealth was used. It became common language to call Venezuela a magical state, one that, thanks to the abundance of oil production, could run a successful country for the elites while also taking care of the basic demands of the popular and working classes while avoiding clashes between classes. Venezuelan sociologist Edgar Lander, in an article titled "The Magical State Is Still There," makes the compelling argument that the logic followed by the Chavista governments mirrors the one of the 70s, and therefore does not constitute a new socialist model. While comparing both the magical state and the socialist petrostate, he says, and I quote, "On the basis of the same relationship with nature and on the same rentier petrostate model, it is not possible to produce significant transformations in Venezuelan society. A model of state capitalism can be created in which income is better distributed and is primarily directed to previously excluded social sectors. Greater levels of equity and reduction of exclusion can be achieved, but the political, organizational, and productive capacity of the society as a whole required for its transformation cannot be generated. In this way, nature will continue to be devastated, and the possibility of making the multicultural republic referred to in the Constitution, the one 1999, a reality will be negated," end quote. Chavez didn't live long enough to have to make this choice, but his successor, Nicolas Maduro, in response to the steep drop in oil prices worldwide, has decided to drastically reduce imports every year, going from $66 billion in 2012 to $13.2 billion in 2017. So it's 5 years. Yeah. This decision is disastrous for all Venezuelans, since they depend almost exclusively on imports to get food and medicine. This has caused a lot of the scarcity we see on the news, and it's a measure that has nothing to envy the neoliberal reforms that previous governments were implementing. Another economic policy pushed by the state that is now proving inefficient and actively damaging is the implementation of a dual exchange rate. This is point B of this section. In 2006, to make food accessible to all, former Minister of Economy Jorge Giordani drafted a plan to provide preferential dollars to businesses that imported these essential goods and sold them at a subsidized rate in the supermarkets. From the beginning, long-established local capitalists worked with the new bureaucracy to take advantage of this system. Some outright stole the money, never importing the goods they declared. Others did import the promised goods, but then smuggled them through Colombia to get a better price or sold them directly on the black market, where the gains were much higher. This profit-seeking logic is how every capitalist system operates, but this case is especially galling because the ones in charge of funding the socialism of the 21st century are the ones actively engaging in price gouging. Both of these policies, when combined with the low price of oil and right-wing tactics to sabotage any progressive measures, gave rise to this unprecedented catastrophe of a crisis that has also led to a devastating and imprecise political conjuncture. Now I'm going into the political crisis. Since the death of Chavez in 2012, the government has suffered a steep decline in popularity. Chavez's handpicked successor, Nicolas Maduro, was re-elected this past May 19th in what became the election with the lowest turnout a Chavista candidate had experienced yet. His ruling, unlike the governments of the past 18 years, comes with no mass base of support. Many blame Maduro as the problem to the political and economic crisis, but the reality is that the administration led by Chavez in the first decade of the 2000s already established the conditions for it. What we do see with Maduro, however, is two developments that weren't clear as of Chavez's death yet, but nevertheless were already underway. On the one hand, the active choice to turn to socially conservative as well as environmentally destructive measures to deal with the crisis, as it's clear, with a drastic cut in imports and the expansion of mining in El Arco Minero, which I'll expand on in a second. Or in other words, the very simple fact that this government is not pursuing socialism in any way, despite saying so. And on the other hand, the more recent turn to authoritarianism to deal with the lack of popular support that is consequence of the first point. I will now deal with both of these points to frame the political crisis before going into the conclusion. The first point, the Venezuelan government is not socialist, nor does it intend to be so. One of the most convincing critiques of the Bolivarian Revolution raised by Venezuelan socialists is that this revolution is not socialist or even anti-capitalist. Even if the economic crisis were due only to external pressures, which I've already argued is not the case, the solutions proposed by the government have proven to be socially regressive and environmentally devastating. The construction of El Arco Minero, the mining arc, is that a good translation for this? Is a glaring example of this and one of the key points of social struggle and activism that requires our attention as socialists. In 2011, it was announced that in order to make the revolution successful, the economy needed to be diversified. And I don't mean diversified in terms of like other areas of production. I mean diversified in terms of other natural resources to exploit, to sell to the rest of the world. And profits needed to come from more sources, even if this meant making some sacrifices. One of these sacrifices was the opening up of 12.4% of the national territory to mining extraction by 150 companies from 35 different countries. This is an extractivist project of unprecedented scale in this country, rooted in the worst aspects of neoliberalism. It threatens to displace over 1 million indigenous people dispersed in 465 towns, who, despite the promises of sovereignty and self-determination written in the Constitution of 1999, have not been given a choice. But maybe even more glaring is the fact that the whole area will be a special economic zone for national development. People are not familiar with what this means. Special economic zones are established as exceptional areas where transnationals can make their own rules, devoid of taxation and free of labor and environmental laws. Venezuelan engineer and environmental activist Cesar Romero, member of the Platform Against El Arco Minero del Orinoco, and I want you to remember this, the Platform of El Arco Minero del Orinoco, says about this region, and I quote, "You go to the mining arc and feel like you're in another nation. It's like the exacerbation of a government project to form a state. This is such a profound issue that it involves not only the environmental aspect, but a whole new vision for a country," end quote. Strikes are not allowed. Activism in defense of the environment is not allowed. The displacement of indigenous peoples is guaranteed. Corruption goes along with impunity. All of this, however, is justified as a necessary step towards Venezuelan socialism, and therefore painfully absent from most assessments of the Bolivarian Revolution. And then now the second point, the decline of popular support being responded to with authoritarianism, which in turn leads to more social discontent and a further radicalization of the political crisis. In 2007, Chavez called for the formation of the United Socialist Party of Venezuela, PSUVE, to unite all the forces committed to advancing the Bolivarian Revolution. Socialists who supported the president but remained critical of the bureaucracy already forming around him were put in a bind. They either joined a top-down party that had the support of millions of workers or entered the political margins. In the end, most socialist formations agreed to participate, and in no time the PSUV's ranks swelled. The party, however, did not rely on its members' participation, active participation, no matter how much Chavez liked to say it did. Instead, a bureaucratic structure where criticism, open debates, and rank-and-file power were often more the exception than the rule took over. The party formalized the bureaucratic layer of nominal Chavistas who were put in charge of different state sectors. In no time, as explained in the section on the economic crisis, the new caste engaged in corrupt behavior while continuing to deploy socialist rhetoric. The government's ideas of funding and supporting popular power didn't work in practice. While Maduro's government's popularity has only dwindled since he took office, the coalition party of the opposition, Roundtable of Democratic Unity, although we can talk about new developments, not gonna get into that now, or MUD in Spanish, has also done the same. Their main strategy has shifted from coup plotting in the early years of Chavismo to street mobilizations combined with electoral campaigns to defeat Maduro, either midterm or in general elections. But the composition of this coalition party gives very little confidence to Venezuelans. A combination of the two leading parties of the popularly hated old regime, smaller right-wing formations, and disillusioned Chavistas have attempted to present an alternative to Maduro that didn't have any electoral victories until December 2015. They are feared as the defenders of rich Venezuelans and US capital who will do anything to stabilize the country for their class and not for the national majority. The balance of forces between Maduro and opposition seemed less obvious by 2014, when a sector of students from middle and upper class areas went into the streets to protest in what became a month-long showdown between a militant sector of the right, Chavista supporters, and the government, causing deaths in every side. 1 year later, December 2015, the MUD had its first and only electoral victory, winning 2/3 of the seats in the National Assembly, gaining the power to propose legislature and remove some Supreme Court judges. This victory, however, was short-lived, since the National Electoral Council has denied every move that the now opposition-controlled National Assembly has tried. The last attempt of the opposition to remove Maduro from office was the campaign for a recall referendum, strategy that had already been tried in 2004 against Chavez. Then in 2004, Chavez mobilized its mass base to consolidate what essentially became a vote of confidence for the president and against the right wing. By contrast, Maduro's tactic has been to stop the referendum from happening at all costs, which was granted last year by the National Electoral Council after dubious concerns on signatures fraud. It was after this latest defeat of the opposition in the summer of 2017 when the most prolonged series of protests of mass character took place. An unprecedented multi-class layer of people came out every day for 2 months while the government continuously denied the problems of scarcity, economic mismanagement, and corruption. More importantly, this neutralization of the opposition electorally hasn't only been directed against the right wing. Independent left-wing formations, such as our comrades in revolutionary organization Marea Socialista, have also been systematically shut out of the electoral process by denying their right to run as an independent socialist force outside of the Chavista elites. This has relegated the independent left to grassroots campaigns that have no room for representation within the electoral arena. With the opposition from the right and from the left severely weakened, Maduro called for a new constituent assembly to rewrite the constitution to give his presidency more powers, again in the name of socialism. This was happening as the last socialism conference was happening. But this was the same constitution that had been drafted through the first elected National Assembly in 1999 and then ratified through popular referendum, a process that had been highlighted internationally for its highly democratic character. Without popular consultation, Maduro went ahead and effectively replaced with this new body the authority of the opposition-led National Assembly. It was also during this last year of electoral campaigns to consolidate Maduro's regime when Vice President of Venezuela, Delcy Rodríguez, stated, and I quote, "We will never cede power," end quote. Statements like this put very seriously into question the democratic course of this revolution, making grassroots activists concerned that they will not be able to freely form an opposition that can democratically challenge the government in place. This extremely polarized political situation has left Venezuelans with no real options to mobilize for. Instead, there is a complete mistrust in elections offering a path to solving the crisis, especially the one this last year with the lowest turnout in Chavista history, making the future of Venezuela very uncertain. I'd like to close this talk by offering a brief summary of what I think are the main conclusions to draw here. The Chavez government managed to do what no other leader of Venezuela has done. Using the old revenues that swelled during the early years of the 2000s, it expanded social programs to provide health care for millions of poor Venezuelans, dramatically increased access to education, and attempted to include historically marginalized sectors of society into the national political process, like indigenous people, for example. They were included in the 1999 Constitution. Additionally, Chavez's opposition to the U.S. and its neoliberal economic doctrines, openly expressed as opposition to capitalism, rightfully inspired millions of people around the world to reconsider socialism as a worthwhile project. These are achievements worth celebrating, but they don't add up to socialism because Chavismo never let real power spread to the grassroots of society. Indeed, any initiatives for popular power depended to receive any funding or support on loyalty to the government. This kind of clientelist relationship with grassroots campaigns has nothing to do with genuine socialism. Once the boom in basic commodities ended, world oil prices plummeted, and the revenues used to expand social programs dried up, exposing the limits of the distributionist model. The response of the Maduro administration has been to crack down on opposition, both from the right wing that has always opposed the government, but also supporters of Chavismo that dissent from Maduro's direction for society. These are our comrades. These are people we need to show support for. These ones are serious activists who are organizing in different campaigns against the exploitation of the environment, the attack to self-determination for indigenous people, the fight for reproductive justice, and for the expansion and consolidation of the democratic structures achieved during the height of Chavismo in the mid-2000s. This, too, must be completely rejected by socialists. The fight for socialism should always stand for the expansion of democracy, not restrictions on it. With Maduro, the bureaucratic layer that had already emerged under Chavez seems to have consolidated and strengthened its hold over state resources. Not only is it clear that there is massive corruption among Bolivarian bureaucrats, but this layer shares responsibility with capitalists in creating and exacerbating the worst economic and social crisis the country has ever experienced. Venezuela has remained a capitalist country through and through, despite the social achievements of the last 18 years. What has failed is not socialism, but a system that has been capitalist in its economic and political domination by a minority over the majority. Relying on a minority, however well-intentioned, to take over a capitalist state and reform the system into socialism has failed before. Socialism from above, in whatever form it takes, is not the successful shortcut we should keep trying. To inspire a new generation of socialists, we need to be able to explain what happened in Venezuela and to re-raise the banner of socialism from below. As Hal Draper writes at the close of his The True Souls of Socialism, and I quote, "Since the beginning of society, there has been no end of theories proving that tyranny is inevitable and that freedom in democracy is impossible. There is no more convenient ideology for a ruling class and its intellectual flunkies. These are self-fulfilling predictions, since they remain true only as long as they are taken to be true. In the last analysis, the only way of proving them false is in the struggle itself. That struggle from below has never been stopped by the theories from above. And it has changed the world time and again. To choose any of the forms of socialism from above is to look back to the old world, to the old crap. To choose the road of socialism from below is to affirm the beginning of a new world." End quote. We have a history of movements from below to look to for inspiration in Venezuela. We can look to the incredible show of force of the Barrios in Caracas that came down in 1989 to lead the first ever mass revolt against neoliberalism. The same layer of people came down en masse from the barrios again to defend Chavez from a right-wing coup in 2002, and they won. We have seen the collective organizing of workers who kept the National Oil Company open and running during the buses strike at the end of that same year, 2002. And we have also seen the breathtaking capacity of rural and urban communities to self-organize economically and politically to defend the gains achieved in the last 18 years and fight to take it a step farther. And then, of course, we can also point to the level of activism that remains fighting for genuine socialism, the one I'm incredibly inspired by, despite the government's efforts to co-opt them or neutralize them. There is plenty of hope to look forward to when assessing the last 18 years of this complex process in Venezuela. But this hope will not be found in the proposals made by the capitalist and government elites. Rather, it will be found in the unwavering efforts of a fighting people who, no matter how hard the process of emancipation gets, will keep trying until victory is achieved. My hope is that as socialists in the United States and in this conference, we can show solidarity with the millions of Venezuelans fighting for that version of socialism from below that can truly transform society for good. Thank you.
The preceding program was a production of WeAreMany.org, a website dedicated to publishing radical and activist media that promotes a better understanding of today's world while also putting forward a vision for a better future. We Are Many is a project of the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. To learn more about this program or to find others like it, check out WeAreMany.org.